Thank you, Chuck. That was a great introduction. If I can live up to all of it. Well, I'd first like to thank the organizers for inviting me. This is the first time I've been in this type of venue, and I really like it a lot. So I'm going to tell you about work that my lab's done over, I guess, about the last 6 or 7 years on stroke and applying new imaging techniques to the problem of stroke, which is a loss of blood flow. And I'll first tell you about acute effects of stroke on the dendrite and the synapse itself. And then, so the middle part of the talk, we'll talk about stroke recovery, remapping of circuits. We've already been introduced to maps in the last two talks. And then for the end of the talk, hopefully we'll get to this, some newer work on optogenetic motor mapping, but also optogenetic techniques combined with voltage-sensitive dye imaging with the goal of looking at cortical circuitry through pattern stimulation. And I thought Matthias did a good thing by putting up the acknowledgement slide first, because these talks, they can sort of go over time, but I realize I'm sort of butting up against lunch too, so I'll try to keep it somewhat focused. So the first part of the talk, we'll talk about the structure, and then we'll talk about remapping, and then lastly some of this novel optogenetic mapping methods. And then these are people in the lab who have really made all this possible, and some of our funding sources. Okay, so we all know what a stroke is, and there's sort of this feeling that with better and better imaging, we could really sort of figure out what's happening on a sort of a synaptic and a circuit level in vivo. So before we did this, no one had really done in vivo imaging of stroke before. And this is anatomy, but a stroke is where you have a deficit in blood flow, and that leads to loss of neurons and networks and computation. And somehow that loss needs to be replaced, or the animal's going to have a long-term disability. So we felt that by sort of using high-resolution imaging techniques to this sort of older question of stroke, we could sort of watch the process much like you'd sort of reconstruct a sort of a car accident, a sort of on a very sort of rapid time scale, and also look at the individual events. And what's really aided us, it's too bad the projector's a little skewed here, are mice, in which we have actually that where we can see fluorescent neurons in vivo, and these mice were generated by Guopeng Fang, and they express in this particular line YFP in layer 5B neurons, and other lines express GFP. And so these lines have really been a workhorse for us, and what we do is we image their apical dendritic tuft up near the pial surface, and it really allows us to study individual spines, individual synapses in vivo during the stroke, and then also its recovery. So this part probably isn't so interesting to people with a physics background, but there's a rich history in stroke. And so what we tried to do is we tried to basically adapt the current stroke models that people were using in the sort of clinical literature to use with the two photons. So the first model I'll show you is a global ischemia model, where we basically block blood flow to most of the forebrain. And this was very useful for doing kinetic studies, because we could stop blood flow actually while the animal was in the two-photon microscope. Another model is a focal middle cerebral artery occlusion model. Again, this is kind of similar to what could happen with a patient with a large clot that might lodge in a branch of the middle cerebral artery. While this global ischemia model would be more indicative of let's say, a heart attack, a cardiac arrest. And then I'll also show you some targeted stroke models where we can, much like David Kleinfeld's work, block individual peel arterioles and produce strokes within parts of functional maps. So the first model is sort of low tech. We put sutures around the common carotid arteries. They dangle down from the mouse's neck, and we could reach into the microscope and literally pull on them. And we can induce ischemia, in this case, for 7 minutes. And then we can reperfuse the animals just by releasing the tension on the threads. And then you could even produce a second stroke. So it's a rapid induction. We measure blood flow, much like David Kleinfeld's lab. So here's red blood cell velocity, 1.4 millimeters per second. So the typical number for a capillary goes to virtually zero, and we occlude. And then we can reperfuse and then bring back the flow. So this really sort of stunned us when we first did these experiments. You know, you're always hoping for a small, you know, some significant effect. But this is the dendritic structure before the stroke. And this is the same dendrite 4 minutes into the ischemia. So this is really, it's happening in people. If blood flow drops, you know, well below 20%, they're going to undergo something called ischemic depolarization. The dendrite's going to go from looking normal to having this beaded appearance. The thing that was even more surprising, I thought it was just sort of game over here. Well, we'll follow it for a couple of hours, and then we'll put down the animal. But the surprise was we brought back the blood flow, so we reperfused the system, and then now the structure went from being beaded and blebbed to relatively intact. So these changes in structure, which can be very sort of severe, can also be reversible. Well, if you look, so we're not labeling all neurons. So we're labeling probably less than 1% of the processes that are in there. And you can see swellings here, and then in between the swellings are compressed areas where the dendrite is probably smaller. So there is a large reduction in extracellular space, but you maybe don't necessarily pick it up in this image. So these well, I think, I mean, so the water extracellularly is going into the dendrites. And I mean, I think if we carefully segmented, I haven't done this because it's always hard to sort of segment fluorescent images and say, you know, what's dendrite and what's not dendrite, and especially when something is undergoing these types of changes. It would be interesting to reconstruct this and then ask, you know, how much volume are we gaining, because there are measurements of extracellular water in the literature. It's a good point. So this type of swelling is nothing new. People have been working with tissue culture cells or patch clamping. If something goes wrong, neurons have relatively normal dendrites. And then in this case, they put NMDA on these dendrites. So that's an agonist of the glutamate receptor. And they also show these beads. This is in cell culture, but similar changes occur in vivo during stroke. So I've shown you that these changes can be rapid, and it can also can recover with reperfusion. To really get at the timing of this, I'll show you a few images in which we were two photon scanning continuously during the induction of the stroke. So this would be analogous to someone just having a heart attack. So here's the relatively normal dendritic structure. The image isn't quite as good because there's not as much averaging here. Here's a few seconds later, or 5 or 6 seconds later. And then all of a sudden, the structure goes from being normal to having this beaded appearance. So this transition from the intact dendrite to the swollen beaded dendrite occurs over seconds. And we've also done recordings of DC potential in these animals during the stroke. And in this animal, we had a DC electrode present. And so we induce a stroke. And the first thing you see is the fast EEG activity is lost. The trace gets thinner. And then at about 218 seconds, you can see there's this big shift in DC potential. So the extracellular potential gets more negative, which means this, the intracellular potential of the neurons is depolarizing. And then coincident with that depolarization, you can see normal structure, normal, and then all of a sudden transitioning to beaded. So the trigger for this is, I'll skip this. The trigger for this is a phenomenon called ischemic depolarization. So due to the lack of energy, the sodium potassium ATPase can't keep up anymore, and the brain undergoes a wave of depolarization. We've looked at this a bit more carefully, looking at intracellular calcium levels during the stroke, and we've used the Arthur Conarith lab bolus loading technique for calcium indicators. And this is just some group data showing that here's the time to change in structure, and then this is the time that we see a rapid change in intracellular calcium levels. You can see they're very well correlated. So some animals, the structure doesn't change right away. I showed you one that happened at 218 seconds. Others, it happens after about 60 seconds. So we use this variability in latency to ischemic damage to look at the relationship between changes in structure and intracellular calcium. You can also make a similar curve for changes in structure and then ischemic depolarization. So these changes in structure occur in response to depolarization. Yes, Fleur. Oh, I'm sure if you looked at a decrease in extracellular sodium, increase in intracellular sodium, you'd see the same. I'm sure all the ions probably go, and water at the No, you're right. What's causing the beating? Breakdown of the cytoskeleton. So what I think is happening is I think the dendrite is, or the actin depolymerization, I think the dendrite is, there's no more cytoskeleton, so it tends to swell. It's probably trying to maybe achieve a spherical shape, but because it's a tube and then it forms regular spheres, and then in between each sphere, the membrane stretches. So I think it's some lowest energy state of a lipid-like tube. That would be, without getting into any physics of it. Yes. No, you don't usually see it break. I mean, and when it comes back, we've never seen. I mean, a dendrite could be lost, but it typically isn't lost over minutes. It's lost over hours or days. I'll show you some that have actually severed later. It's not as extensive, and I'm not really sure why. Axons are much harder to image in vivo because, I mean, not everybody appreciates, but the axon is 300 nanometers in diameter. They're really small, and the signals are small, so it's tough to do that. Bob.
So main mechanism here for all.
Presumably, and then we haven't done that or provide. I mean, you could do experiments where you provided glucose locally or pyruvate or something to try to keep them going. We haven't done. Yes. Yeah. Glutamate. Yeah. So we've funny enough, we've put on glutamate receptor blockers, and it doesn't stop the major change in structure. But anyway, so that's what we see with global ischemia, so where we block all blood flow in sort of most of the forebrain region. So one of the questions we had about this is, you know, you're only creating a stroke for 7 minutes. It's not really that, it's heart attack, it's not really stroke. So we decided to go to the most sort of widely used stroke model, and that's the middle cerebral artery occlusion model, which involves passing a nylon suture up through the carotid to where the middle cerebral artery comes off the circle of Willis. And this particular model is a bit more challenging because we cannot push the suture in while the animal's in the scanner. So we have to take the mouse out, have to flip it over, and we have to push the suture in, and then we confirm the blood flow is blocked, and then very quickly bring it back to the two photon. The nice thing about the model is the middle cerebral artery feeds the more lateral side of the brain. So what we'd expect to see here is a gradient of damage reflecting territory that these arteries irrigate. So this is the structure before the stroke, and you can see some dendrites. The right side of the image is more lateral, so the right side would be expected to be more vulnerable if we're blocking the middle cerebral artery. So this is this is about 40 minutes into a 60-minute occlusion. We take stacks to reconstruct the image, so it actually takes quite a bit of time to do this, and we tile across the cortex. And what you can see here is the right side has these beads, whereas the left side is relatively intact. So the left side gets the blood flow from the midline, from the anterior cerebral artery system. So the sort of distribution of blood flow is predictive of the damage. So now this animal underwent a 60-minute occlusion, so we decided to reperfuse it, and we were pleasantly surprised to see not complete recovery. You can still see some beads here, but very pronounced recoveries. You can see, and some of these dendrites, even as they go across into the more ischemic territory, it actually changes within a dendrite. Possibly. We haven't done that type of an analysis on this, but I mean, it could be that the ones that don't recover, that their soma is in the really deeply ischemic zone. It shouldn't come as too much of a surprise, because we know that, I mean, people have, I think that Dick Chen's lab did this patch-clamped isolated dendrites, and we make hippocampal slices, we're cutting lots of dendrites, and they survive, and it's not surprising that we could have gradients of recovery. These animals were able to recover with reperfusion, but what we found was that that if we looked at areas that were more lateral in this sort of core of ischemia, and this is looking at them with histology. This is 3 hours after stroke, a 60-minute occlusion. We found that the neurons that were closer to midline recovered, whereas the ones that were more lateral still showed these beads. You can also see beaded axons down here as well. So these are axons that are going down into the spinal cord or the striatum. It's just a close-up here. This is showing the beads with another technique, Golgi staining, similar idea. And then, again, one half of the neuron is beaded, the other half isn't. This half happens to point towards the stroke. So for the first part of this talk, we've shown that stroke can have rapid effects on synaptic, really, structure. and some of these effects can reverse with reperfusion. So in the middle cerebral artery occlusion stroke, which is a focal stroke, so the core area does not recover after 60 minutes of occlusion and reperfusion. Whereas there's a penumbra area, which is sort of either has partial blood flow or is close enough to an area with blood flow, and it's able to undergo these sort of reversible changes in structure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually all the energy metabolism in neurons is local. So if you cut dendrites, you look at them in the EM, and you see mitochondria. I mean, so the mitochondria, I don't know, maybe third or fourth of spines have a mitochondria in them, and then most terminals have a mitochondria. So I think, you know, there's no protein synthesis, or I shouldn't say that. There's some protein synthesis in dendrites. There's no transcription. Maybe that may be the only thing you'd be missing out on. So. No, we haven't. We have not done EM, but there is there's EM data from Christian Harris's lab with a different paradigm with cooling, where you also see very profound changes in structure. And in those animals, they did do EM, and they found that the ones that were cooled and rewarmed, that the synapse was still intact. Presumably, I mean, that was a standard method of making. They used a hippocampal slice production protocol, actually, and the spines all disappear, and then they all come back. And there is a net loss. I think they're actually spinier when they come back. That was the result. They're lost, and then there's.
In one of your first slides, Tim, that some of the spines that went away came back in the same place.
Yeah. It seems to be exactly the same place. And so what we think is that maybe proteins within the PSD are still there, and that due to energy failure, you have actin depolymerization. It's sort of like having a tent, taking the poles out of your tent. But the little grommets and things that you put your poles back into are still there, so it comes back together looking like the original dendrite. So I've told you about structure. So what about function, and what happens over much longer time scales? So that's sort of the next part of the talk is. So let's say you've had a stroke, and let's say there isn't reperfusion. So I don't have time to present the data, but when you get reperfusion in these models, you can recover a certain amount of EEG activity from the area that was ischemic, and you can also recover, let's say, if you make the stroke in the forelimb area, you can get a forelimb map back in that area when you reperfuse. The forelimb map is sometimes a little bit smaller, but it's nonetheless, it still comes back. So what happens to these animals that don't have the fortune of having us there and reperfusing them? What happens if there's an occlusion and it's not reperfused, and then it forms an infarct, which is a cavity, where it's actually loss of neurons? And so For this part of the talk, I'd like to switch over to a different stroke model, and that's where we make more selective reductions in blood flow using something called photothrombosis. And in this particular case, we can target individual arterioles that feed, let's say, the forelimb area or the hindlimb area. So we can map out these limb representations before the experiment using intrinsic optical signal imaging, and then go in and target the arteries that actually supply them. And so this is just the photothrombotic technique, which I won't really go into, but it's a way of using light to produce clotting. I think David Kleinfeld probably talked about this. So we use lasers. This is just a short video clip. This is wide field microscopy, just showing the laser and the blood vessel. This is sped up 6 times, but the process only takes about 2 minutes, and then you can clot a vessel. See, one thing I learned from this that is kind of scary is if you clot an arteriole, so this is about a 30, 40 micron arteriole, you can clot just one arteriole on the PL surface and it can destroy most of the forelimb map. So when people are doing craniotomies in mice and a few vessels break, it should be taken seriously, because that can produce quite a large functional deficit. So for this part of the talk, we'd like to to go with the theme of maps and then remapping after stroke. So in most cases, we're going to destroy the forelimb sensory map and then try to understand how other sort of maps in the neighborhood, so the motor forelimb, motor hindlimb, sensory hindlimb, how they may sort of take up some of the function lost by this when this forelimb map is lost. Okay, so this idea that we have remapping after injury is nothing new. So here's data from an actual experiment. Here's a forelimb map. This is an IOS map. And then in this animal, we targeted the forelimb map with photothrombosis. And in the same animal, 8 weeks later, we mapped it again using intrinsic optical signal imaging. We actually made this map through the thin skull, and the subsequent one is through a craniotomy. And so you can see the infarct, there's no forelimb response there. Forelimb response is coded in green. But now the forelimb response has moved over to the motor cortex. And also there's some forelimb response down in hindlimb. So we became very interested in this remapping of function that occurs over this 8 week period. I'll show you some calcium imaging data towards the end of the talk. It's really very specific, almost absolutely. Okay. Yeah, it does. But the problem with that is rodent motor cortex is kind of funny, because if you stimulate hard enough in the forelimb sensory, you can get motor responses. And the motor cortex, it overlaps a lot with forelimb sensory cortex anyway. So a lot of people call it the sensory motor cortex in the rat and mouse. So what could help aid remapping? So we know there's a lot of circuit redundancy. I've just mentioned that, so the sensory and motor cortex being sort of fused together in the rodent. We know that there is plasticity in the adult, classic work of Mersnick. We also know that there's structural plasticity in adult animals from work of Swoboda and Gann and others. And then there's also this idea that stroke somehow sort of unlocks plasticity, sort of like what Bob was talking about yesterday. That stroke may do this as well, but on a longer time scale through permissive patterns of gene expression. So the first thing we sort of looked for was we'd create these strokes, and so we thought that if there would be synaptic loss, well, at least the neurons next to the stroke, they would no longer be receiving input from this stroked area. So we might see an initial reduction in synaptic density. And then over time, we may see replacement of synapses and spines as these peri-infarct areas were supporting recovery. So we did in vivo imaging here. So this is the craniotomy, just showing how we use blood vessels as landmarks. And these are spines over 3 weekly time points. And I'll just sort of skip to the punchline because this has been published. We saw synaptogenesis in the peri-infarct area, about a 4-fold increase in spine turnover. And these are longitudinal measurements, so measuring spines in the same animal before and after stroke. So 4-fold increase in turnover. And surprisingly, though, the turnover was restricted to an area about 200 microns from the infarct. If we looked 700 microns away, we found that the turnover rates were at about the same level as a sham control animal. So most of the structural reorganization that we could detect in the layer 5 neuron tuft was happening right next to the infarct. So there did seem to be reorganization of structure. You could see it on the spine level, as I showed you in the previous slide, but you could also see it just looking at projections of the dendrites. So if you looked at one of these strokes, what you saw is on the border of the stroke, you found that neurons, this is a cartoon view of a stroke-affected neuron. As I told you before, as you go closer to the infarct, there's more damage. So you tended to have neurons that were asymmetrical, sort of like trees after they've been through a hurricane. So at the infarct edge, all the dendrites tended to kind of point away from it. This is an example where we followed the arbor of a neuron before the stroke, and then 2 weeks and 4 weeks after the stroke. And what we found was that this neuron's arbor, this is it reconstructed. We're looking at it from the side now. This is from 2-photon data. So this was the arbor before the stroke, and then 2 weeks after, part of the arbor was severed, but the rest of the arbor survived, and it even appeared to either stretch or grow over time. So this is a typical neuron with a sort of symmetrical arbor. You then place a stroke, and what tends to happen is you lose dendritic density proximal to the stroke, but then away from the stroke, you tend to gain some length, or perhaps it's a mechanical effect where we're merely stretching the dendrites or just making them more linear. That was the result. Here's a short little movie. It's going to repeat. This is the process, the stroke. And you'll see this neuron will bleb and then die. This other neuron's partially affected, and it survives, and then its dendrites grow and elongate slightly. So what I've shown you is that there's structural reorganization over rapid time scales, actually during the strokes, is surprising major changes in structure that are in part reversible with reperfusion. And this vulnerability seems to correlate well with where blood flow is. I've also shown that on longer time scales, neurons with severed dendrites can survive and perhaps continue to contribute to circuits, and there's ongoing synaptogenesis in these regions. So we next wanted to move from structure. Yes? We haven't tried to manipulate it in any way. It would be good to compare it to, you know, sticking tetrodotoxin in there with a mini pump or something. And if you remove input, I mean it's complicated because some, you know, you have homeostatic mechanisms which are going to tend to, if you remove input, then you would get more spines, but then there's other mechanisms where you remove input and you'll have a loss of density. So, but we haven't tried to recreate it. I guess that's a short answer. Yeah, Bob.
Talk a little more about magnificent time warp shell
that. So that's something that we don't have a good handle on. So when we create that bowl-shaped infarct, we typically are not imaging in the infarct itself. So we tend to have to image on the edge. And it's very difficult to predict exactly where that infarct edge is going to be. So we don't have a good handle on the transition from the sort of the live neuron to somebody that's committed to cell death. So one of the things I'd like to do is to have a mouse with a caspase indicator or some protein that would tell us that the cell death cascade has been activated, and then I'd know to kind of image those neurons, you know, more frequently or work in that area. But we don't have a good handle on that. We certainly know that neurons on the edge with a severed dendrite can survive, but it's luck when we find them. Okay, so we wanted to look at function over sort of wider spatial scales, and we created a preparation called the giant craniotomy, which in the mouse is a 7-millimeter cortical window that goes across the midline, this allows us to really have access to most of the cortex for imaging. And the technique that we've really employed the most recently is voltage-sensitive dye imaging, much like what Carl Peterson uses, and using the dye RH1692 that Grinwald's lab synthesized. And one of the advantages, I think, of this dye is it's, touted as a direct measure of membrane potential. We don't know if it's measuring membrane potential in neurons or glia. Presumably it's both, or mostly contribution to neurons, but the fluorescence is directly proportional to depolarization. So if you use a multi-electrode array, and this is from Carl Peterson's review, and you measure something like a C2 whisker map in the mouse, you get this nice tight map, and that's because the array is primarily picking up action potentials. If you look at intrinsic signal imaging, and you also look at the C2 whisker response, it's also this nice tight map, which is restricted to the barrel. However, if you look at voltage-sensitive dye imaging, you see right after you stimulate, the C2 whisker lights up. But then if you wait a little longer, these responses spread to much of the barrel cortex. So from Carl Peterson's work and others, it's thought that these voltage-sensitive dyes really give us something in addition to the electrode. So they give us a true measurement of, I shouldn't say, I guess membrane potential is kind of maybe a little difficult to conclude that, but a true measurement of cortical depolarization, both spike-mediated and sub-threshold. So we've employed this in the stroke-recovering animals, and one of the advantages is the great time resolution these techniques have. So this is a forelimb stimulation here, and this is the average of 10 trials under urethane anesthesia. So stimulating the left forelimb, so you see the response start on the right, and then it'll spread towards the midline, and then you'll see it in the other hemisphere.
So a single tap?
That's a single 5-millisecond tap, yeah. So it's very, very subtle tapping. Like, you can barely feel it yourself. It's a piezo moving the paw a few hundred microns. So this is a typical map before stroke. So this is the center of the forelimb area. So if you map the forelimb area with intrinsic optical signal imaging, it would look like this. But over time, this response can spread to much more of the hemisphere. What you see in the stroke animal is something different. So there was a stroke created here. So we see an activation near where the stroke was, but now the response, it spreads through even more of the hemisphere, and you'll see it in the other hemisphere as well. So if you look at this in a sort of frame-by-frame movie, so up here is a stroke, and then this response, it goes on here for 300 milliseconds and really spreads through much of the affected hemisphere and then into the other hemisphere as well. Well, it could be that in this animal, that where the stroke was, there's a transcolosal projection. So in that, you may have lost the fast ipsilateral response. I will show you some animals later where the response is entirely in the other hemisphere, where it's remapped. So quantification of this type of data, what we found, that really the major effect was that in the stroke recovering animals, the responses in the forelimb area were reduced, but when we'd stimulate the forelimb, we'd still get responses in nearby areas such as hindlimb and motor cortex, and the kinetics of these responses were extremely prolonged. So this is the response half width, 50 milliseconds before the stroke, or in actually this isn't longitudinal, but 50 milliseconds in animals that were shams, and then 150 up to 200 millisecond half width in the stroke recovering animals. So somehow this information in these remap circuits is being propagated over very wide areas and much more slowly as well. Okay, so this brings up an answer to one of Bob's questions. Is I showed you voltage-sensitive dye responses, which reflect, you know, thousands of neurons and also so glia and sort of everything. How are individual neurons processing information in these stroke recovering animals? So one of the features we saw in the iOS maps was that things were less specific in the stroke recovering animal. So we've destroyed the forelimb area here. There's a new forelimb area fused with the motor cortex and the hindlimb. So this forelimb responsiveness 8 weeks after stroke that's kind of spread out in the cortex, do these cells, do they still respond to hindlimb as well? Are there some cells that become forelimb cells in hindlimb and others that remain as hindlimb? So the only way we could get at these types of questions was to use a technique to monitor individual neurons in vivo. So we used calcium imaging from layer 2 neurons, and then we asked in these novel map representations with mixed responses, do single neurons process information from multiple limbs now? Do we see really indications of disinhibition or breakdown of specificity in these reorganized maps? So this is histology, but we would inject Oregon Green BAPTA 1 AM, where right next to the infarct, and we'd examine the properties of layer 2-3 neurons in these areas. So here's the injection, and this is done in animals different time points after stroke or a sham animal. And so we destroy the forelimb area and then look at the properties of single cells. So in this application, you have to focus on layer 2-3 neurons because really their cell bodies are the only ones that are readily accessible with 2-photon, although I'm sure we could probably image deeper neurons, layer 4 or even layer 5 neurons with some improvements. So this is the slide that answers Bob's question. So in the sham or a control mouse, if you look at a layer 2 neuron that's sort of in the center or even towards the edge of a forelimb intrinsic optical signal map, what you find is that here's three trials. These are three different neurons. These are averages. In this case, all three neurons respond to contralateral forelimb. They don't respond to contralateral hind limb, ipsilateral forelimb. So ipsilateral means the non-cross pathway, or ipsilateral hind limb. So if you look at sort of a chart of the percentage of neurons that are above threshold exhibit a significant response, it's about a fourth of the neurons respond at all, and they respond to contralateral forelimb, and there's very little breakdown in specificity. So this is just averaging everything together here. So they're really specific. If you go to hind limb, in this case, I mean, it's easier to see it with a second, but you can also pick out these signals with a single tap. So I think the advantage of the voltage-sensitive dye imaging is that you have a huge area to image across, so you can see smaller events. So if you go into hind limb, again, it's about 25-30% of the neurons are specific to the contralateral hind limb. And you can map this out. You can even look at the borders. So here we're color coding the responsiveness here. And so these contralateral forelimb neurons, hind limb, and there's very little overlap. It was hard to look at the border here because there's a vessel going right across it. We haven't done much behavior because behavior is tricky in these animals just because they're good at kind of masking things, and so they look okay. We haven't looked at it systematically, but I'd say it happens pretty often, but it could also be an artifact or a limitation because you can't really sample there and brain's a little deformed. So I know David Kleinfeld has looked for structure around vessels and it's something he's working on, but it's an interesting question. So in the stroke animal, if you look at the iOS maps, they weren't as pretty, where you had nice red hind limb areas and green forelimb. There was this mix. So this is the iOS map. And then now, if you color code the neuronal responsiveness, the projector's messed up, but you can see there's neurons all over the map here. And this is 1 month after stroke. So this is looking in an area in hind limb, which is also showing some forelimb response by the iOS map. So now, if you look at, here's two neurons as examples. Here's one neuron that responds to all four limbs. Here's another neuron that responds to two limbs. So in the previous slides, I showed really almost absolute specificity in these sensory maps. And then in the stroke recovering animal, it's not as if you have some neurons that take on the new role. It's as if things just have become very kind of messy or disinhibited. It's just another example of this color coding in these recovering areas. So again, neurons that respond to multiple limbs. One way you can look at it is to just average all the activity together. And here's 1 month after stroke. So this is in a sort of a bit of forelimb area that was left, and then forming one of these new maps. And you can see it does have a preference for the contralateral forelimb, but then the other limbs are very well represented. 2 months of recovery, and this it's becoming more specific. So that was a trend that we saw, that over time these reorganized areas became more selective. So these are all adult mice. So the stroke typically starts at about 2 months of age to up to even 3 months of age. And so they're going out to, 5, 6 months. So they're adults. So this is a model of some of this this remapping process. So before a stroke, you have these nice boundaries. After stroke, what happens is you're in the infarct, you're going to lose function, but at the sort of the edges, function is retained, and then over time, at a month, you start to get this sort of encroachment of forelimb responsiveness into the hindlimb territory, and then over time, some of the hindlimb map becomes forelimb responsive, and the whole thing becomes a bit more specific as this new map forms. We haven't really gone out after 2 months, but that would be interesting to see if there's even greater specificity.
Do you have any idea what's happening
in
the
dog? No. Yeah, but we haven't. I mean, we haven't looked at any somatotopy of thalamus. But that's a great question. I don't really know how to. That's not our expertise. But so one of the models we have is that in the animal before stroke, there are some. Let's say if you're looking at forelimb, that there's some. Thalamic input to the hindlimb, that there's a small number of fibers that go to the hindlimb, but that interneurons normally keep these off-target connections in check. And then after stroke, somehow there's removal of this inhibition, and things get a bit less specific, and that helps these new maps to form. Again, hypothesis, but not no firm data on an interneuron mechanism yet. They're probably going to be there. I guess we could look at if there's a change in density. We haven't though. So with assessing individual neurons, we find that they show signs of disinhibition, but over time, the responses become more selective. So let's see. Okay. So one of the questions we had is to have these changes in maps, do you need sort of new synaptic connections? Do you need rewiring? Or is it possible that existing wiring could somehow support recovery? So this is a really fundamental question, but I think very difficult to address because you would need some way to selectively control the new circuits. And unless you had I don't know how you would do it, but some optogenetic experiment. So we tried something a little bit simpler, and that was to ask whether if we create a stroke, and then now instead of waiting 6 or 8 weeks, can we start to see some signs of disinhibition within the first few hours after the stroke? And if we could see signs of disinhibition within hours, it was possible that some of these things just reflected a change in the balance of existing wiring, that we don't really need to evoke new thalamic wiring or intracortical wiring or birth of interneurons or something, that it could happen just because of loss of input that may lead to disinhibition. So in this experiment, we did voltage-sensitive dye imaging. This is just in one hemisphere. It's a single tap of the forelimb and contralateral forelimb. And then on the right side, you see a forelimb response. and it's over with here by 130 milliseconds. In this animal, we produced a stroke which destroyed this upper part of the map. So you can see the stroke area here. Upper part of the map is gone. So one thing that was kind of neat about sensory maps was that if you created a stroke in half the forelimb map, the other half still worked. So it's almost like taking a bite out of an apple or something. It's still, you can see this sharp demarcation. But what was interesting is after we destroyed the upper part of the forelimb map, now the voltage-sensitive dye response started to invade regions that were associated with the hind limb and then into more posterior areas of the forelimb. You can also see the response is becoming a lot longer in terms of time course. So we quantified this in a number of animals. This is kind of a mess here with the projector, but yeah.
So if you look, if you expand your field of view off to the right side,
yeah,
you get sort of equal spreading in both directions, or is it always the sort of stroke region and the spared region more than the island?
I think the craniotomy stopped here, so it would be hard to say. That's a good question. Like, does it try to follow some anatomical pathway? I mean, one question is each stroke is a little bit different. So, yeah, it's no. I like that though. We haven't really looked at that. So this is the quantification of the shifts in these maps. So this is a profile across the map. So distance and sort of function. And so you have a hind limb map and a forelimb map. Okay. I thought I was getting a hook there.
Great stuff. Well, you know, it's because the ghost image in a different color.
Yeah.
Is making it part of the,
yeah.
Yeah. That's great. That's great stuff. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you for your nice introduction. And
it's really, yeah, it's really good.
It's good to.
You know, this most interesting. There's been this question about what causes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time that there's been a kind of get at it.
Yeah, we're trying to, you know, some way of, you know, sort of seeing as believing type thing.
So, do you have accurate estimates of real time flash recording of information or contaminated by dyes? What I'm asking about,
I mean, it would be neat to have an electrodes in there too to double check it somehow. But I can, if I don't get a chance to show, I can show you channel rhodopsin stimulation in different places and voltage sensitive dye imaging, which does seem to matter where you stimulate based on how it spreads. So, no, we're trying to do that now. We're going to do it. We're looking into getting the different mice, but I think we're going to do it just like a post hoc analysis. So collect the data and then do the immunostaining and then figure out which ones are interneurons, because I think it's maybe 5% or so should be interneurons. Does that sound right? That looks a lot better. Okay. Okay. It's convincing. Well, I appreciate everybody. I'm not sure we lost anybody, so that's good. okay. So, I don't know. You guys probably want to go to lunch, too.
No, we're gonna go. You have 35 minutes left.
Oh, okay.
I'll
get into the optogenetics part. Okay. So basically the message here, so you had the hind limb and the forelimb maps, and then after stroke, so the blue is where the stroke is. So this is a deficit in blood flow that we mapped using laser speckle, and we show that in blue. And what happens if you look 100 milliseconds after tapping the paw, the forelimb response that you get is sort of shifted towards hind limb. If you look 100 to 200 milliseconds after tapping the paw, this is that delayed response. It's really shifted into hind limb. So these later responses are even more sort of widespread in the stroke recovering animal. So this was a sort of a model that we had, that perhaps there was some weak thalamic input that was taking forelimb-specific information to hind limb, and then somehow after stroke through loss of inhibition. And one thing we need to consider is that this region of cortex is probably normally inhibiting the hind limb area, normally keeping these off-target responses in check. So if you remove this, you just by taking it out of the circuit, you can even disinhibit. You don't really even do anything actively. So we know from sort of classic in vivo work, this is from Rasmussen and others, that did intracellular recordings in vivo, and they indicated the presence of subthreshold inputs. And this was in the raccoon S1 cortex. So they could do mapping, and they found that 20% of neurons receive input from non-preferred digits. And this is sub-threshold with classic difficult intracellular recordings. And so we also know that neurons, so this is a layer 5 neuron reconstructed by Capaday, that their axons can span very large regions of cortex. So we don't really need to propose new circuits to see some indications of remapping, because there is diffuse connectivity already there. So for the last part of the sort of the circuit part of the talk, I'm going to go into even larger strokes that we've created. And our hypothesis here is that if the stroke gets big enough, that what we might be able to do is to push function to the other hemisphere. So if you have a small deficit, or this is sort of really small, you're going to have reorganization in the sort of peri-infarct area. But if you have a very large stroke, there's really nothing with similar function nearby. So to get a new map, you may need to have a predominantly ipsilateral or non-crossed response. So this is the normal contralateral response, crossed response, but there's lots of circuits by which you could get novel maps. So we indeed do find, if we create a large stroke that affects both the sensory and motor cortex for the forelimb, this is the relatively small stroke case. This is the control, and then small stroke. What you see is remapping near the infarct, but prolonged kinetics. So it's 120 milliseconds after stimulation. Here's a larger stroke, and then now little response in the stroke-affected hemisphere, but a sort of diffuse response in the other hemisphere. And that's 8 weeks after stroke. So we also asked the same question. Can you see some of these interhemispheric changes in signal processing over really short time scales? Can you see these these shifts in laterality, so whether you get a crossed or uncrossed response over hours. So we've also looked at this using photothrombosis. So get you first to focus down here. So this is the forelimb response, voltage-sensitive dye, both hemispheres before stroke. So here it is sort of peaking 40 milliseconds. And then it sort of decays, you know, pretty much gone by 160 milliseconds there. So this is a fairly large stroke. And then now we're stimulating the left forelimb. And you can see the response is mostly on the left side, not on the right side. You do see some response on the right side, but interestingly enough, it's in the motor cortex and along the midline. And you also see when the response is on the left side, it's really delayed and it's affecting a lot of the hemisphere. So this is a case where we're absolutely sure here, based on the blood flow, we only made a stroke on the right side, but we've really shifted the balance to the left side of the brain. This is less than 2 hours.
Are
yeah.
Those the whole time,
yeah. 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 No. They're under your things. Yeah. We have mice that don't have a callosum. This line of mutant mice, and it's. Yeah, you see, we're still processing the data, but it looks like you maybe see some shifts in these animals as well, which makes sense because if you destroy enough function here, I mean there's no signal to send across the callosum anyway, so that's why you could get a shift in laterality and. In a callosal mouse, but we're still working up the data from. Yeah, so that's one of our.
What is the absolute size?
Yeah, it's about 2 millimeters across, typically. This is all unpublished stuff on the bilateral lesions. I think I'll skip this part. So one of the things that we found in these stroke animals was that the ipsilateral responses could be relatively preserved in these animals after stroke. So that's measuring in the other hemisphere. So again, this idea that you get perhaps disinhibition. So if anything, the ipsilateral response gets a little bit larger. Another way of looking at inhibition is instead of stimulating the stroke-affected paw, so the stroke's on the right side here, we were stimulating the left paw. So now we're going to stimulate the right paw, and we're going to image in the good hemisphere. And so if the stroke was causing a reduction in inhibition, what we might expect is in the good hemisphere that we might expect an increase in its response. And that's what we saw. So here's a response to the good paw. So the right paw, and then if you look, here's the response in the left hemisphere, so good paw, good hemisphere, the typical response. And so this is a response to the right forelimb, and then looking in the left hemisphere, you can see this response is now huge. So the stroke is disinhibiting the other hemisphere. That's our interpretation of it.
So yeah. How many trials would take to the
This 10.
Over and over again.
10, yeah.
So the course of 10 trials pretty consistent, or is there any game change situation
So we're doing, typically it's a 20-second interstimulus interval here, so we also do some what we call no trials, where we don't stimulate. Voltage-sensitive dyes, there's a bleaching artifact, so you need unstimulated trials for normalization. So no, we don't really see too much of a change. There's a lot of spontaneous activity. So if you look at it without averaging, you don't really see too much. I could show you lots of movies of spontaneous activity as well.
And that goes up.
It changes. I wouldn't say it goes. I mean, the frequency increases, and it. What you tend to see is, you can see, in the peri-infarct area, it's mirrored in the other hemisphere too. I don't think we've done this analysis in the acolosal mouse. I can't say what the result is, but yeah, that's. And I guess there's some caveats with using those mice. I mean, they've grown up. They may have other deficits or ways of compensating, or connections that we don't know about. As far as I can tell, I mean, I don't know what fraction of, there's acolosal humans. I guess it shows up when people take part of studies and things, and you know, so and they're relatively functional. Yeah. So this is just the quantification of these increases due to the stroke affecting the other hemisphere. Let's skip this part. I think I'll skip this to you. Okay. So the idea that you can get intracortical or interhemispheric disinhibition is also observed in more. So the classic work with cooling in primates. So a similar thing where you would the unaffected in hand. So you'd cool the other hemisphere. And that can increase the receptive field. So it's some effects of stroke immediately could be due to just a loss of input. So we asked if we could mimic this by sort of putting the cortex or the thalamus asleep. I don't know, for some reason we started out with lidocaine and then we went to TTX, but if I'll tell you the punchline is if we put lidocaine in the cortex or TTX in the thalamus, we can increase the responsiveness of the other hemisphere. And this is three animals with silencing the cortex, I guess. Yeah, you see the increase. We can, yeah. So, I was just saying. Just put this slide together. So if you silence the right cortex, you can increase the response of the right paw and the left cortex. So it's all consistent with the stroke causing loss of some form of transcolosal inhibition or through some cross system. You can do the same thing if you silence the thalamus here. Yeah. So. So it was starting to look like that stroke, this some of this reorganization that we see, a lot of it that we see at 8 weeks could be explained by what we see at 2 hours, this sort of reduction of inhibition and then unmasking of circuits. But we did find one thing that was different in the 8-week animals. And what we found was that if we created a large stroke, we got an ipsilateral or non-crossed response. And what we found is if we put so here's the okay, you can focus on this panel. So if we put if we look at the ipsilateral forelimb response and we put lidocaine in the cortex, what we find is that this response is not affected in the stroke animal. The stroke animal, when we see responses in the other hemisphere, that they're due to some sort of uncrossed pathway that they're not dependent on this stroke hemisphere at all. But if you see an ipsilateral response in a control animal, is reduced by cortical lidocaine injection. So we think the major difference we found in the stroke recovering animal at 8 weeks was this pathway, some sort of uncrossed pathway that if it's a large stroke, you don't involve the stroke affected hemisphere at all. And we know that because if we inject lidocaine in here, we still see this response. So that was one thing that suggested that these redistributions of activity that we were seeing at 8 weeks weren't all mimicked by what happened at 2 hours, that this predominant ipsilateral response was really attributed to some type of non-crossed pathway. So for the last part of the talk, I realize I'm presenting a lot of data here, but I'll just go into some methods for optogenetic mapping. If you want to see this, most of it's unpublished. Someone asked the question, what happens to motor cortex when sensory responses map to motor into the motor area? And so we really wanted to do motor mapping in mice, but we were intimidated by doing these impalements with the electrodes. It was seemed very difficult to have to do that like 60 times or something. So we turned to optogenetics, again, aided by Guopeng Feng and the channel rhodopsin Thy1 mouse that he created. And we used it for motor mapping. So much like what Penfield did with electrodes and patients, you can now do in animals with light. So we built a system in which a mouse lays on a stage, and then this stage moves the mouse under a laser, and the laser can stimulate a predetermined array of points, and then while it's being stimulated, we make EMG recordings or video of the paws moving, or we use a motion sensor. And so we can create a map of which areas of cortex can cause the muscles to work. This is a short little video clip. So you'll see the asterisk will show you when we successfully hit part of the forelimb motor cortex. You can see lots of flashes or nothing happens. It's just looping. There it goes. But that's how the raw map is made. So we can stimulate. It used to take hours to make one of these maps. So now you put the animal under this thing, and it goes to these points, but 1 point a second, and can whip off a map in 3 or 4 minutes. So these are 169 points, and we had EMG electrode in the hind limb for this particular map. And then what we did is for each EMG, we just sort of compressed it into a little thumbnail. And so you can get a kind of a picture of which area of cortex tends to cause hind limb EMGs. You can then rectify and integrate these and also average trials and then make a hind limb motor map. At exactly the same time, if you have leads in a forelimb muscle, you can make a forelimb motor map. You could make 20 motor maps at once if you had enough leads, because you're stimulating all points in this particular map. So you could also do it with motion using a camera. So these are just some simple motions, and then just showing that it's not all noise. So this is repeating the stimulus 3 different times, and this is tracking the paws. It sort of moves up in a complex pattern. You see them do it here. So they're anesthetized here, which is the big advantage here is that I like the anesthesia because it allows us to do hundreds of, you know, thousands of stimuli, and we can interrogate all sorts of different areas of cortex. You can have multiple lasers, you can look at interactions between areas. I think it's going to be a kind of a frontier. So an advantage that we have over the fibers, so a lot of people stimulate channel rhodopsin with a fiber, but you can't move the fiber very easily when it's cemented in place or something. So we use the craniotomy, and then we have the whole cortex is there to stimulate. So these were two areas that produced different movement patterns. So we're... Oh, yeah. I know. It's going to be very dependent on how the limb is held, and it's complicated. But we were surprised that for the same position, we could reproducibly stimulate different movements in different areas, just a sign of specificity. So we foresee systems with many lasers and galvanometers, independent targeting, and really interrogating the sensory motor system. So the last part, this stuff is kind of hot off the presses. So I showed you motor mapping, but what would be really kind of neat would be to combine the voltage-sensitive dye imaging with channel rhodopsin. And so the advantage there is I showed you that sort of those targets, like that checkerboard of targets. So you could have those targets, and then at the same time, you could be imaging activity and look at intracortical connections. And we think we've been able to do this. And that's a hind limb map there. And so you see it spread to the other hemisphere. You've seen those already, I think. This is optogenetic activation of the hind limb area. It's probably a stronger activation than we need. But you'll see where the origin is, there's a bleaching artifact, so we can't actually use that data. But you can see the response in the other hemisphere. And patients. It's a little easier to see if you just look at the kind of blow-by-blow maps. So this is stimulating the left hind limb. So here's the left hind limb response. It goes over to the other hemisphere through the callosum, dies down. So this is stimulating the area that is the hind limb S1 with the laser. And so you have a sort of a bleach artifact there. You start to pick up this transcallosal response. You can see this spread, and then dies back down. So we're now really comparing the stimulation of
Can I ask a question? So the dynamic seems to be very different at 80 milliseconds when you are doing the channel rhodopsin simulation as opposed to the electrical simulation in the film itself. You get at 80 milliseconds you get this very strong activation of the left hemisphere already.
Yeah, so part of that is it normally takes, so we're going from the hind limb, you know, up through the spinal cord of thalamus and to the brain, so that takes 12 milliseconds or so. And then it probably only takes, I don't know, 2 or 3 milliseconds to go across the callosum. So I think what we need to do is we need to shift the timing of these maps based on. Right. Yeah, that would be good to do with a virus or something. That's a good point. I'll show you the barrel cortex and the forelimb. I'll skip this. So one of the things that I get kind of intrigued by here is the top is forelimb optogenetic stimulation. And what you can see is you stimulate here, and then the response sort of goes posteriorly, and then it kind of hooks towards the midline here. I don't know if you can see it. This is when we stimulate the forepaw electrically. So this is the natural response. And then if you look at the optogenetic response, it kind of looks a bit like that. which intrigued me. I mean, I think we need more data. This is, and then so here you, they begin to resemble each other. With the barrel cortex, if you look at it, you'll see the stimulation, you'll see the response here, then it'll jump up to the motor cortex, which is exactly what's been reported by Carl Peterson. So we think that through optogenetic stimulation that we you know, it's early days, but we may be able to look at, you know, by actually stimulating forelimb S1, we may be able to watch what's downstream from forelimb S1. And it's amazing that this seems like it may be working because these are layer 5B neurons, which are output neurons. You wouldn't expect them to maybe be wired up properly. So this is what we'd like to generate with this. This is only from four animals. And what we've done here is we've stimulated all these areas along the bottom. So M2, forelimb, hindlimb, barrel cortex, this is posterior association area, retrosplenial cortex, visual cortex, V1, V2. And then these are places where we've measured response, and we color-coded the responses. And what really comes out strong is that when you stimulate barrel cortex, this is a contralateral response. So here I'm stimulating, like, let's say, right barrel cortex, and then now I'm measuring in the left hemisphere. These areas are all connected to it. So M2, forelimb, and hindlimb. So there's this kind of cluster here. And so barrel cortex has strong contralateral responses, whereas the visual cortex, we don't see that to much of an extent. The same with hindlimb. When we stimulate the hindlimb, we also get strong responses in the barrel cortex, of course, the hindlimb in the other hemisphere. So we think that with genetics that we only did 8 points per hemisphere. So I'm sure we could do more points. The problem is we need to do trial averaging, and we have a interstimulus interval of 5 seconds, and we have a blank trial, so it's more like 10. So it takes to make one grid of 16 points with averaging takes about 45 minutes, which is kind of a long time. So I think it'll be difficult to do lots and lots of points unless we can have really good dyes or calcium indicators or protein indicators, things that don't bleach. But you know, I think in a couple of years it may be possible to do hundreds of points and then to read out from hundreds of points simultaneously. So in conclusion, I guess I showed you a lot of stuff starting out from dendrites blebbing and then recovering. New maps, some signs of reorganization that may occur quick, whereas others, this ipsilateral response may take weeks to develop, and then some novel mapping techniques, and then all the people that have helped, Majid Mahajirani and Diana Lim are the ones doing the voltage-sensitive dye imaging, along with David McVie now, Oliver Ayling, Tom Harrison doing the motor mapping. So I guess that's it.